Thank you very much. Good morning. I want to start off with a thank you and a little bit of an apology. So first of all, a thank you to everyone who puts together Kol Yom Rishon. It's always a pleasure to see Rabbi Arbisfeld here especially. And thank you to Rabbi Waitman, to everybody who puts together this program, not just for doing that, but for putting up with me, because I'm always difficult to deal with, because I would like to have a topic and like to have Mar Makomos in a prompt fashion, and I'm usually a little bit distracted. So it takes a while to get to the sources in time, to get the topic in time. And Rabbi Charka for so many years, Rabbi Rabshore, always so patient and so gracious in dealing with me, and continue to let me come back, even though I always give them a hard time. So this week especially, it was even a little bit less responsive. So I have to apologize at the Mar Makomos that they tried to put together, despite my lack of cooperation, are helpful, but don't have everything that we're going to talk about. So there's a little bit that's here and a lot that's not here. So my apologies to them and to you, and my gratitude to everybody for continuing to deal with me. So, yes, exactly. It's to make a point about Torah Shabbat Peh. Exactly. We want to show that not everything is b'ksav. So I thought we would talk a little bit about a topic which is kind of a general topic, but it seemed like this slot here in between Lech Lecha and Vayera might be a good time to talk about it. And it has to do with a general question of how we relate to halachic ethics in light of some of the questions in general ethics. And some of the topics in these parshios, connect these two parshios, seem to be a good opportunity to consider the question, because one of the major issues that comes up in philosophy and in ethical philosophy is the question of, do we view issues in ethics through a formalist lens or through a consequentialist lens? Meaning, when we make our decisions, do we have rules that are formalized? Do we have principles that we go by and we take them as valid in and of themselves in all circumstances? Or do we look at the situation in front of us and working off the assumption, let's say, that we want to help people and not hurt people? So do we look at the consequences of any given situation and say, okay, in this situation it's going to be helpful, so we'll do it. In that situation it's going to be harmful, so we won't do it. And we look at everything based on this situation that we're dealing with, rather than having generalized rules. And one of the main examples that's often used to illustrate this question has to do with our attitude towards lying. So do we avoid lying? Do we try to be honest because it's morally wrong to lie, and therefore, as a general principle, we don't want to lie? It's wrong. It's something that we don't do. Or do we say that lying is wrong for fact that it's hurts people, that it tends to bring harm to people when you mislead them, when you are dishonest with them? And therefore, a consequentialist might say, well, let's look at the given situation. If the situation is one where, in this case, not saying the full truth will help the person I'm speaking to, so then maybe in that instance, it would be morally correct to lie, because we would look at the consequences of that situation rather than a formalized rule. So I thought that maybe we could pose the question, especially now, again, I'll explain why, of how does the halacha view issues like this? Does the halacha view issues through a formalist lens, or does it view issues like this through a consequentialist lens? So this is a topic that comes up in Parshas Vayera, because in Parshas Vayera, we find a discussion where the issue of honesty comes up. There is a discussion between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Avraham Avinu, that here Avraham has been told in the end of Lech Lecha that he is going to have a child from his wife Sarah, and in the beginning of Vayera, so Sarah gets the news, and she's a little skeptical. She says, you really think I'm going to have a child at this point? Do you have any idea how old my husband is? You think it makes sense I'm going to have a child now? So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates that story one pasuk later to Avram, it comes out a little differently. It comes out not so much with a focus on Avram's age, but essentially it comes out that, yeah, Sarah's a little skeptical about the whole child issue. She said something old, basically to obscure the fact that it was Avram who was old. It made it sound like she was focusing on her own age. And the Gemara in Maseches Yevamos tells us that this reflects the principle that it is mutter lishanos b'fnei hashalom, that it's permissible to, let's say for now, tweak the truth. I don't want to say lie, because there might be a reason why the Gemara is somewhat cautious in the way it phrases it, but lishanos, to change a little bit in order to preserve harmony, in this case between man and wife, so that is apparently permissible, and it's actually a debate in the Gemara. There are other sources that are brought to prove the point first. So first there is an opinion that it is permissible, and then the second opinion is no, it's not permissible, it's actually a mitzvah, it's a requirement, that if one is in such a situation, one is obligated to emphasize peace over truth. That's the din. And then the Gemara ultimately says, we see that even God himself does this, as we find in this instance with Avram and Sarah and the Ribono Shel Olam. So this is an interesting question, because we mentioned this is one of the examples that is most often given to illustrate the difference between a formalist approach and a consequentialist approach. How do we look at a question like this, saying something that's not true with a goal to spare the feelings of the person you're speaking to, or to preserve harmony, and there's no other consequence, you're not going to hurt anyone by saying something that's not 100% accurate, and all you will bring about, if you assess it correctly, is a positive impact on both the person you're speaking to and everyone else involved. So how do we view that? So do we say, no, we're formalists, and it's not acceptable under any circumstances? Or do we say, no, we are consequentialists, and if the consequences of this situation are that it's going to be helpful, it's going to be beneficial, then this is not a typical dishonesty situation, and therefore it is to be permitted. Okay, so far so good. So this is a topic of analysis within this sugya. We all agree that it's permissible to tweak the truth for the sake of peace. That's an explicit sugya, and again, if Kadosh Baruch Hu himself does it, it seems like it's at least accepted on that level. There is somewhat of a debate in the Gemara whether it's permitted or obligatory, and among the Rishonim also it seems to be a debate. A number of the Rishonim take the position that it is obligatory, seems to be the view of the Rush and the Rif, commenting in a different context, while the Rambam's a little bit up for discussion how he perceives the issue. And then the later commentaries in the Achronim, when they analyze this question, so they note that there are essentially two perspectives one could take towards this question. One could take essentially what would seem to be a consequentialist perspective and say that in this situation, we have to decide that lying is not a problem, that lying is defined by its consequences, and if the consequences are positive, so then that's simply not a prohibition of sheker at all. While there are others who would maintain what's closer to a formalist perspective. I say closer to because we indicated that an absolute formalist perspective would say, sorry, you just can't do this at all, you can't lie. But here, maybe even a formalist might agree that there's still what to weigh, and there's still, or at least a semi-formalist might agree that we can weigh up the consequences and say, listen, it's still wrong, it's still lying, but it's more important to preserve harmony. Harmony is a greater goal, so disturbing the peace would be a greater violation. So we struggle between two actions that are both wrong, and we have to assess which one is more problematic and follow the path that that dictates. So that's a discussion, and there are many ramifications. The question of just how careful does one have to be to avoid saying anything extra that's not true? Does one have to avoid doing this on a constant basis? Is this something that's very limited in its applicability? So there are extensive discussions, and the topic I think we spoke about here in the past, so I didn't want to spend the entire time focusing on it, but this is an issue that has a number of ramifications and essentially revolves around this question, how do we view this analysis? How do we view this situation? The question of saying something less than fully true when harmony is the goal. So is that simply we're not concerned at all about the issue of dishonesty in this case? It's not considered to be a moral problem when these are the circumstances? Or are we still concerned, but nonetheless we assume that the goal of harmony outweighs the problem involved with dishonesty? Okay, so far so good. So this is one example where this question of our general approach is going to come up, is going to present itself. Now, it's interesting, and I think that this is true for most of us, that the question of a formalist approach or a consequentialist approach is usually not an absolute. It's not that we have one attitude towards, but that different types of circumstances sometimes call for different types of attitudes. So when it comes to, let's say, dishonesty, without speaking on behalf of any specific philosopher, I think it's safe to assume that many of us do take a consequentialist approach, because if one were to be asked, for example, would you lie to save someone's life? So presumably, without taking a formal poll, I think most of us probably would do that, would assume that we should lie to save someone's life, because in such a case, the consequences are going to dictate a very clear situation, a very clear path, and that would seem to be a pretty logical, pretty safe approach. Does that sound reasonable? Most people would probably lie to save someone's life. Right, so again, that's a halachic approach, and I think that reflects the fact that most of us would be in sync with that approach, because we would assume that this is something which we would probably look at with a consequentialist lens, and therefore that would probably be the path we would take. Now, that wouldn't necessarily be the case all the time. What approach would we take to an issue with higher stakes, such as murder? So would we take a consequentialist approach to murder, and would the halacha take a consequentialist approach to murder? So here, our initial instinct is that we presumably would not. Why? Because we know, especially those who are learning Daf Yomi, so this came up in the past few weeks, several weeks ago already, but the Gemara tells us in the Maseches Sanhedrin that murder is something which is in the category of Yehareg V'Al Yavor. In other words, it's viewed as an absolute. Now, we are not permitted to murder an innocent person, emphasis on innocent person, because as we'll discuss, it's a different situation if that person is trying to kill you or kill someone else, but if the person is innocent, so we wouldn't kill an innocent person, even at the cost of our lives. That's what the Gemara tells us in Maseches Sanhedrin, that if somebody says, murder that innocent person or I will kill you, so we are still not permitted to do that. We're not permitted to murder the innocent person. So that conveys the sense that we look at murder in a formalist way, that we look at it essentially as an absolute, and it's not up to us to weigh it against other things, to bring up the question of, well, maybe in this situation it seems like there'll be a different kind of consequence, but rather we look at it as an absolute, and we say, this is just not something that we are permitted to do, and that's the end of the story. Now, one could raise the question, well, what exactly is the reason for that? Because the Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin has an interesting way of explaining it. The Gemara says that, exactly, the Gemara says, and I apologize for not having some of these words like said on the sheet, but the Gemara says that we are not permitted to kill someone else in a situation like this, because there is a logic that's offered there. My chazis, the dama didon, didach, tsumakit fe mi dami didon. How do you figure, how do you come to the conclusion that your blood is redder than his blood? And in other words, to decide to kill that person because you have assessed that your life is more valuable, so who told you such a prophecy? Who gave you this insight, this authority to decide that your blood is redder than his? So it's interesting to pose the question of what does that statement mean? Does that statement mean that theoretically there could have been a consequentialist approach? We could have said, listen, if you had some type of a blood measurer or blood assessor that would tell you that your blood is indeed redder than his blood, then okay, maybe there would be what to talk about. But because you can't know such a thing, so therefore we can't make that decision. So is the Talmud saying that theoretically there's room for consequentialist thinking, it just practically speaking is impossible because we don't have such insight? Or is the Gemara really giving us essentially a formalist principle here, saying, listen, this is not something that can be assessed, this is not something that you can even start thinking about, and therefore it's a rule across the board, you can't murder people no matter how you assess what the outcome will be.
Tausler says if they would throw you on top of somebody, you don't have to resist.
So that's an interesting question. Right, so that's not necessarily definitive as far as this point. So he's bringing up a Tosfos, which we'll have to see if we'll have time to get to that, because it doesn't necessarily change the mechanics here. It changes your involvement, which is something that we'll talk about. So we'll have to see if it's a relevant question or not. No offense, but we'll have to see if it's going to be a part of what we'll discuss. Ayin Dalet. Ayin Dalet. Ayin Beis will come up though, so that was a little prophetic. But yeah, Ayin Dalet is where this is. So in that context, so there is room to wonder, what is that line coming to tell us? Is that line telling us potentially there is room for some consequentialist thinking here? Or is it saying that this is essentially a formalist principle? Now, it's also interesting to maybe speculate that maybe that line itself may reflect the reason for formalist thinking. Because one might say that, in general, maybe consequentialism makes sense. If we're trying to live lives that are positive and not negative, we're trying to do things that are helpful and not harmful. So let's look in every situation and decide, okay, what's going to help here, what's going to hurt here, and follow accordingly. Let's live a life that's going to be positive and not negative based on assessing every situation. So what's wrong with that? Why shouldn't we say that? Why is that not a great approach to life? So presumably there's a lot of subjectivity in such decisions, and there's a lot of bias that could enter such decisions, and the higher the stakes are, the more concerned we are about letting people live life that way. So when the stakes are a little bit lower, okay, so maybe that's a more reasonable approach. So we could say, okay, live your life and decide, okay, will this be helpful? Will this be harmful? Is this something that will help people? Is this something that will hurt? And decide accordingly. But as the stakes get higher, so we get more concerned about letting everyone use their own subjective scale to assess this. So something with such high stakes, like murder, we're not so comfortable letting everyone decide, well, I'll live my life and go every day, make a decision, should they kill me or not, based on whether they think they'll have a more positive effect. I'm not willing to put my life in the hands of everyone's subjective assessment that way, and therefore we should assume that it's a cross-the-board policy. We're not going to let individuals weigh up these situations and make these decisions. It's got to be taken as a rule, no murdering. So perhaps that itself is the reason for formalist thinking, and maybe that's what the Gemara is getting at. Not that, my chazus, you happen not to have the knowledge to know whether your blood is redder, but essentially we're not letting people make this decision. We're not going to let you be the one to think about whether your blood is redder than anyone else's and to assess it that way. This is simply a policy that you can't make these decisions. So this is a question, because poskim do wonder, so what about if there is some type of metric? What if there is some type of reason to think that maybe the math would be present? What if there's some reason to think that there is basis for you to make such analysis? So for the most part, even though this is a little bit of a discussion, for the most part, we don't allow ourselves to go there, even when it seems like there is room to evaluate such things. And this is expressed especially in the words of the Rambam in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, in Perek Hey, Halacha Hey. So he takes one view in a well-known debate that appears in the Yerushalmi Trumas. The Yerushalmi Trumas has a discussion that what happens if a group of people is challenged by some kind of an enemy, and the enemy says, we're threatening to kill all of you, but we will spare you if you give one of us, if you give us one of you, you give us one of you to kill that person, so then we will spare the rest of you. So there is a debate in the Gemara, Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, about whether it is permissible in any circumstance. And the possibilities are that if they name someone, if they say, this is the guy we want, so then it might be permissible. That was the view of Reish Lakish. That was the view of Rabbi Yochanan, rather. And Reish Lakish's opinion was that it has to be specifically somebody who is Chayiv Misa, somebody who already has a status that they deserve to be killed, so then, okay, such a person can be handed over. But if an innocent person, a person who's not classified in such a way, is requested, so then you can't hand them over. So here happens to be that a number of the Rishonim, such as the Meiri and the Yad Rahman, Sanhedrin, Ayin Beis over there, and also it seems like the view of the Shulchan Aruch is that if they name a person, so that person can be handed over. And it seems, the view of Rabbi Yochanan, it doesn't matter whether the person is known to be Chayiv Misa or not. While the Rambam takes the view that the person has to be Chayiv Misa. So here, it's interesting, because it seems that this would be a case where consequentialist thinking could be invoked. We could say that, listen, here it's a question of this whole group versus this one person, and this one person is going to die anyway, because if you don't go along with what they're saying, they're going to go after the whole group, which includes this person. So if one is thinking consequentially, it's not a hard question. So then, for sure, it's the safety of the entire group weighed against this person, and this group including this person. So from a consequentialist perspective, it should be permitted. And yet, the Rambam doesn't allow it. So it seems like this is an expression of formalist thinking, that handing this person over to be killed, even when the consequentialist view clearly would indicate it should happen, doesn't necessarily allow it. And this is something that we find coming up in a number of areas of halacha which border on ritzicha or involve ritzicha, that when it comes to ritzicha, we have essentially an absolutist attitude. And the Kesef Mishnah comments that it seems like, even though one could raise the question, well, doesn't the Gemara say that my chazis, the whole issue is you can't evaluate whether your blood is redder than his blood, but if you have such a math going on to so many people against one person, doesn't that seem to indicate that here you should be able to assess that the impact is going to be better? So the Kesef Mishnah writes, he believes there was a tradition that murder is Yehareg Val Yavor. It's not only because of the logic of my chazis, and therefore this is viewed as an absolute. Again, conveying that it seems like we see this through a formalist lens.
It comes to be that one person might actually be worth more than the entire group.
Right, that's also possible, but here, like, it seems, and there are situations where one could enter into the conversation, that it seems like the math does, as far as we know, especially if we're asked to make these decisions, it seems like we have the elements in front of us to make somewhat of a reasonable, rational decision, and yet, nonetheless, we're told we don't go there. That, for a formalist perspective, we don't enter into the question of murdering someone or handing someone over to be murdered. It's simply not an option. Now, this is an important question to consider when we consider the issue of the ethics of war in general. And this is the connection to Parashas Lech Lecha. So we mentioned we kind of break a bridge between Vayera and Lech Lecha. So yesterday in Parashas Lech Lecha, we read about the first war in human history. We read about the war of the four kings versus the five kings, and Avraham Avinu's involvement. And there is a lot to discuss about that. We know that Avraham afterwards is offered bounty, is offered a lot of profit that came from the situation, and he declines it. And the Torah says he declines it because he doesn't want to give the impression that this is what made him wealthy. But there's also other aspects to it. And there is an interesting discussion. There's a contemporary Sefer HaLaTorah called the Chavetzela Sashar and HaLaTorah, who has an interesting discussion over here, where he notes that a part of Avram's thinking is that he wasn't really sure how to assess what had happened, that he was a little conflicted about the conflict, he was a little unsure about how to view his actions. And this is suggested by Rashi. If you look at Rashi in the beginning of Perek Tesvav, Rashi and Tesvav Aleph in Lech Lecha, so Rashi suggests that Avram was a little concerned, would he pay any price for the people he had killed in war? And the question seems to be, this is the way the Chavetzel Sasharon explains it, that he knew that it was a legitimate mission to go save the life of his nephew. We have a halacha of Rodef, and therefore, when somebody's life is threatened, so one has the right to kill that person, whether he's threatening you or threatening someone else, that's legitimate. So that much, okay, he had confidence in. But the question is this simply a situation of rodef, in which case one only has the right to go after the person who is threatening him? Or was this more? Was this a milchama? Was this a full-blown war? In which case the rules shift a little bit, or significantly. And what would differences be? What would the nafkamina be between a straight rodef situation and a milchama situation? Well, one difference would be, can we involve anyone else who's not directly a part of the threat? If somebody is on that team, vaguely speaking, but is not the one actually doing the threatening, are they also a fair target? And also, secondarily, this question he was confronted with then, is there a concept of shalal? Is there a concept of booty? Can he take from what was conquered during the war? Is that also something that comes to him, or is that something that has no relevance here because it's simply addressing a localized rodef situation, and there is no such notion of taking from what was won in war, so to speak. So essentially, that was his doubt. That's the suggestion here. And after he received these words from the king of Sdom, he essentially became reassured that it was a Mulchama situation, and he had other reasons why he wasn't interested in taking any of this material good that was offered to him. So the question of shifting from one to the other, shifting from a straight Rodef situation to a Milchama situation, is an interesting one, and we have to figure out what exactly flips the switch from one to the other, and what gives you the whole new landscape that would change such things. So it seems that this is something which Rav Schechter discusses in his Sfarim Bikvei Hatzon, something also which Rav Asher Weiss discusses in his Sefer on Devarim, Menachas Asher Al HaTorah, and Parshas Shoftim, if I'm not mistaken, that you don't really have an explicit source in the Torah or even in Shas about this, but as Asher Weiss writes, you have to look to Tanakh, that all of Tanakh is filled with Melchama, and we have to assume that this is something that we can derive principles from. Essentially, presumably, what's going on, as Rav Schechter notes, is that we shift identities from individuals to nations. So now we are perhaps still working off a Rodef principle, if that's relevant to the situation at hand, but it's not the Rodef of one individual against the other, but it's the Rodef of one country against the other, and therefore we look at it in that sense, and that changes the parameters of what's happening. So if somebody was chasing after you in the streets of New York City, and the only way to defend yourself would be to indiscriminately shoot in the air and shoot innocent people, so you wouldn't be able to do that, because this individual is chasing after you has nothing to do with all the innocent people who you would be also hitting when you try to defend yourself in such a way. But when we have a national identity, so then the laws of war mean that we have a shifting perspective, and that might be a legitimate way to assess what's going on. And that's something that has many ramifications. Essentially, it's a discussion. Minchas Chinuch and others raise the question of what is the role of Pikuach Nefesh, Docha Es Hakol, when it comes to Milchama. A number of Svarim talk about this, that we know that normally we say Pikuach Nefesh is Docha everything, with the exception of the Harvo Yavors, as we mentioned a minute ago. That normally, if you need to save your life, if there's something that's very dangerous, let's say especially if it's a positive mitzvah, so you would be exempt from performing that positive mitzvah if your life is threatened. Now, when it comes to Milchama, we have a concept of Milchamas Mitzvah, we have a concept of obligatory war, and clearly war is highly dangerous, much more so than any other mitzvah we would exempt ourselves from because of Pikuach Nefesh. So why don't we say that one is exempt from war always because of that? So clearly we can't use that metric. If that concept was relevant, so the whole notion of Milchama and Milchamas Mitzvah, any kind of Milchama, wouldn't exist, because there's no way to have a Milchama without very high levels of threat to nefashos. So it seems like Pikuach Nefesh takes on a different role here. But that doesn't mean to say that it's irrelevant. It means that it's assessed through a different lens. That when we're talking on an individual level, so then we say, okay, should you fast on Yom Kippur? So we're looking at the individual as a person, and we consider their Pikuach Nefesh as a single individual. In the context of war, so Pikuach Nefesh is still a factor, and the generals are certainly going to make decisions about what steps to take and what steps not to take based on Pikuach Nefesh, but it becomes Pikuach Nefesh of the klal, becomes Pikuach Nefesh of the group rather than as the individual, and it gets weighed in such a fashion, and essentially perhaps the whole license, assuming those are the kinds of circumstances that we're talking about, could also be from a Pikuach Nefesh or a Rodef lens, but viewed on the national level. Rav Schechter in a Sefer goes on to note that once we're looking at it through a national lens, that could be true also about territory, that territory also could come to define a national Pikuach Nefesh. So if a foreign army were to come to America and say, we're going to take over Washington, D.C., we're going to make sure not to kill a single person, but we're going to take over Washington, D.C., or even worse, Washington Heights, and make it ours, and make that a part of our territory. So that would also be under the rubric of a national Pikuach Nefesh, because even if the human beings are protected by our spared, but the territory that comes to define the nation is going to be taken. That also falls under the broader heading of the question of Pikuach Nefesh on the national level. So all of that becomes a part of the equation as far as how one assesses some of the issues as pertains to the ethics of a wartime conflict. And when it comes to Rodef, so we do have the principle that if it's possible to accomplish the goal with less force, so then we're obligated to do so. So on an individual level, we say, that if it's possible to save your life without killing the pursuer, but simply by disabling him, so then that should be pursued, that should be the path to follow. And so too on the national level, that if we have the right to wage war to protect our nation, but if it's possible to protect the nation with a lower degree aggression, so then that should be the path to do. It should be a constant assessment of what is necessary and what isn't necessary, because on the one hand there is a license to pursue the conflict, but it also has to be viewed through the lens of what's necessary in order to resolve the situation of the Radifa. That's one possible lens to look at it. Another topic, or another perspective, which also could inform the nature of conflict, I think this may also be related to a topic we spoke about here in the past, I don't remember anymore, but there is a question of a mitzvah called din. And this could be relevant, perhaps, especially, let's say, conflict in which America is pursuing a terrorist nation, especially under those circumstances where there's been acts of terrorism or something of the like. So there is a discussion about one of the Sheva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach that might be relevant, and it appears in the Chumash, in the Parsha, coming up a few weeks from now. So this is overall a Sefer Bereishis topic today. So a few weeks from now we'll read in Parsha's Vayishlach that there is a whole episode where Shimon and Levi take apparent retribution for what happened to Dinah, and they kill all the males of Shechem. And there was a major debate among the Rishonim as to what justifies their actions. Why were they able to kill all the men of Shechem? So here, you look in places that are not typical. If you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Melachim, so the Rambam explains why that is. I think that actually is in our sources, Perek Tes Halacha Yudalid, that there the Rambam explains that this has to do with the mitzvah of din, that we have Sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach, six prohibitions and one positive mitzvah, and the one positive mitzvah that we have is justice. And there is a discussion to be had, what does that mean? What exactly does the mitzvah of din entail? So the Rambam understands that the mitzvah of din means to enforce the other six. That if there's a violation of the six Noahide prohibitions, so the mitzvah of din requires us to correct that and to punish that. So here, Shechem, the individual, was guilty on a personal level for his attack on Dinah. So the city of Shechem should have punished him, should have tried him and dealt with him because of the mitzvah of din. And because they failed to do so, so therefore they themselves were subject to punishment. They were also chayisa themselves. And the Ramban disagrees. The Ramban, it's interesting, so you wouldn't look for the Rambam normally in Mishneh Torah for the interpretation of stories in Chumash, so this is a very unusual place to look. So the Ramban, in the commentary to Chumash, then gets into this whole machlokus with the Rambam, and the Ramban has a number of reasons for disagreeing with the Rambam's interpretation, essentially noting that it's not really the case that din as a positive mitzvah, that's a crime of omission, shouldn't necessarily have with it a chiyuv misa. And we see from the narrative in the Chumash that Yaakov was upset at them. It seems like what they did was wrong, and the Rambam is suggesting it was justified. So he understands din in a different way. But there is a whole room to wonder. So if you have a mitzvah of din, so what does that tell us in terms of something like the death penalty? This discussion comes up. So normally we have a prohibition of murder, as we've seen, and a prohibition of murder is one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, so it applies across the board. Everybody is prohibited to engage in murder, and yet the practice seems to be, even though it's been controversial and debated, that governments have assumed that they are permitted to execute people who have committed crimes. So the question comes up, how does that play in the framework of halacha and the framework of the Sheva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach, which prohibit murder? So the truth is, here we actually have to ask the question from the other direction, because it seems like the Sheva Mitzvah Noach, and this is a Parshas Noach topic, so we'll cover most of the Sefer Bereishis today, but this is the Psukim in the end of Parshas Noach, talk about the death penalty for murder. And it seems to be that not only does the Noahide code allow for Misas Bezdin, allow for the court to execute murderers, but really for all of the violations of the Mitzvos B'nei Noach, which is where the Rambam is coming from here in the context of the omission of Din. So if that's the case, and then one might say, well, wait a minute, are we obligated to advocate for the death penalty for everything? Not only should we advocate for the death penalty, but we should say across the board we should push for the death penalty in all situations. So that doesn't seem to be the attitude. Doesn't seem to be the halachic attitude. You have to figure out exactly why. And it's interesting, this is a question that was discussed by great poskim, particularly in relating to governors of New York State, where the death penalty has been a topic of much discussion. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva that was printed in his tshuva, so it was written to Hugh Carey, who was the governor at the time, where he advocated a position that said the death penalty is on the surface legitimate, but it's still something that we have to be very careful with and to know when to apply and when not to apply. So in other words, recognizing that there is a place for the death penalty, it's not ritzicha on behalf of the government, it's not considered to be an act of murder, but at the same time, clearly not advocating for it for all offenses and recognizing that it must have somewhat of a more nuanced approach. So this is reflective of another approach that we see. I remember years ago, I don't remember if I told the story here or not, but I remember many years ago, I once stumbled upon a magazine. This is back when you stumble upon things actually and not on the internet. It was a store. So there was a copy of New York Magazine that on the cover, you'll see in a moment how long ago this was, but on the cover of New York Magazine, it had a story about the 100 smartest New Yorkers. Clearly a very scientific study that was able to assess exactly who were the smartest New Yorkers, and we're proud to see that the two of them were associated with Yeshiva University. So one of them was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who was on the list. So there's just two problems with him being on the list. One is that he wasn't a New Yorker, he lived in Chicago. I used to commute here, right? And two is that the picture that they had was actually a picture of his brother, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. But other than that, it was nice to see Rav Aaron on this list. And it was interesting to look at how they proved it, because how do they establish the status of all of these 100 people? How do they show how they were the 100 smartest New Yorkers? So it's only a magazine, it's not a book, so they couldn't really prove it at length. So they had room for one quote for every person on the list. They had a picture of their brother and a quote from them to show how they were one of the 100 smartest New Yorkers. So how did they establish that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik belonged on this list? So they quoted a point about the death penalty. So here's where you can place it in time. Governor Cuomo had just been defeated. Not this Governor Cuomo, the previous Governor Cuomo, the father Mario Cuomo, had just been defeated by George Pataki. So this is already a while ago. And Pataki had run on a pro-death penalty platform. So Rav Aaron was quoted as saying that you should be very careful about the death penalty, and the Talmud says that a Sanhedrin, it's a Mishnah and Misach Makas, that a Sanhedrin that executes once every 7 years, once every 70 years, is considered to be a bloody Bezdin, and New York State should be careful it shouldn't become a bloody state. So it's interesting, here's again a great Rav talking to a governor of New York State, and it's interesting that one might think, well, okay, that's not really relevant, because that's talking about Mises Bezdin in a specific context. Here we're talking about the Din of B'nai Noach. It has its own set of rules. It has its own set of parameters. To quote from there is interesting. It's not necessarily an obvious choice. So in order to understand Rav Aaron's position as quoted in that magazine, we have to look to a better magazine. We have a journal here called the Beis Yitzchak, which is the Torah journal Yeshiva publishes every year. So many years ago, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik had an article there where he explained his perspective towards the mitzvah of din by B'nai Noach. And he said that even though on the surface it may seem like there is a chiyuv misa for everything, that for any violation of the mitzvos B'nai Noach, it's appropriate to have a punishment of misa, so he understood it differently. He understood that misa represents the upper limit of judicial discretion, that the role of the dayan, the role of the judge in the B'nai Noach system is to keep order in the world, is to keep people from eating each other alive, as the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says. So therefore, the dayan has the right, the judge has the right, the shofet has the right to decide what has to be done, and that could go up to and including even the death penalty. But doesn't mean it has to go there. That's a part of judicial discretion. And therefore, it makes sense to think about it carefully and maybe to decide that this is not a situation where the death penalty is called for. That requires a constant evaluation, and that's a part of the process also. So here, when we consider international warfare, could also theoretically be motivated by din, if we understand, like the Rambam, that was a reason Shimon and Levi were going after the people of Shechem. So especially when there are concerns of terrorism and the like, so we're taking action against terrorism, that's certainly the violation of the Noahide Code, where a case could be made that the mitzvah of din on a global level is justifying the conflict. And then again, the question of just how far to go with it presumably would also be subject to an assessment of what's necessary in order to push back, to defeat the terrorism. How far do you have to go in order to accomplish that goal? And the way Rav Aaron understood the whole notion of how din is executed, that would perhaps give some perspective here also, that one has to assess what's going to take in order to defeat the terrorist actions, and within that framework to make whatever decisions are necessary. Okay, so far so good. Makes sense more or less. So within this whole context of how to decide how to wage the war and how to assess such situations, so that gets us to the trolley problem, which is a part of the title, so we have to make sure to get to that. So this is a very much a part of the question. So if you're familiar with the trolley problem, there's different ways to refer to it and different ways to formulate it. This is a philosophical, ethical question that's been discussed in different contexts in different ways for the past 100 years or so, especially the past 50 years or so. It appears in different forms, and the truth is it appears presumably in halachic sources also in different ways. But the way the trolley problem is formulated, and that's why it's called that, is because it's usually illustrated with a trolley, that there's a situation where you have a trolley that is barreling down a certain path, and there are 5 people who are on that path, and they're not going to be able to move out in time. Maybe they're tied down to the tracks, or however you want to formulate it, but they are not going to be able to escape the trolley in time. And you have the ability, let's say you can flip a switch, where the trolley will move to a different track, and these 5 people will be spared. But there's one innocent, currently unthreatened person sitting on the other track. So when you divert the trolley to this new track, you're going to cause the death of that one person. But in doing so, you will spare the 5 people who are threatened now. So do you flip the switch? That is essentially the question. There are many different forms of this, many different versions. But essentially, what seems to be at the core of the trolley problem is, to go back to how we started, is the formalist view towards murder. Because if we take a consequentialist attitude, so it seems like this is a pretty straightforward decision. We could save 5 lives, we'll sacrifice 1, so the math is clear. We don't know anything about any of these people, so we'll go for the saving the 5 over the 1. Consequentially, it seems to be a pretty straight path. So why is this such a challenging question? Why do we struggle with this? Because we perceive that murder is something that we look at formalistically, and we're not so quick to allow murder even when the math seems to make sense. So the nature of the question, the root of this issue, is this murder or not? Flipping the switch to make one train go towards the one unthreatened person, would that be considered an act of murder towards that person? I think it's fair to say that that's essentially what we're struggling with. We're going to run out of time soon, so should we take... Well, that's the question. Is it? Because you're not doing anything. So if you just let the train go, so clearly from a consequentialist perspective, it seems that's much worse. You're letting 5 people die as opposed to 1 person dying. The issue that seems to make it complicated is, and the reason that's not just the clear answer, is because that we're not doing anything. So if we're not doing anything, okay, you can't tell me I'm a murderer. But if I'm going to make the train go to the other path, maybe that's an act of murder, and that's where the complexity of the issue seems to lie. And as I mentioned, there are many different versions. You can find at least 4 or 5 and probably many more versions of this question. But one of the examples of how it gets shifted a little bit is, what if there is an individual Let's say you have a larger person, and the person is just standing along the side of the road, and you could pick him up and throw him in front of the train. So that will stop the train, and that will save the five people, but that will sacrifice that one person again. But here, it's literally a biadayim. You're going to actually move him. So is that worse? Does that change the thinking? Because now, not only are you causing the death of this one person, but you're literally putting him physically in harm's way. So as it gets closer to your active deed, so it becomes closer to what we perceive as murder. And that's why, again, the question seems to intensify, because the closer we get, or the more sure we are that this is an act of murder, then it becomes a complicated question because of this formalist approach to murder. So this is something which could come up anywhere, but it's clearly also an issue that appears a lot in war ethics and in situations of conflict. And to give a pretty comparable example, so let's say there is a missile that is heading towards a populated area, and one could divert the missiles. We have a Patriot missile which could go and knock the missile out of the air, but what would happen is it's now going to go away from the populated area and land in a less populated area. So it will still end up killing people, kill far fewer people, let's say. It'll go to a much less populated area, but an area that also has people, and people who are not threatened to begin with. So you're going to cause the threat to these people by diverting the missile into their path. So is such an action permitted? And does it make a difference if we're dealing in war, if we're dealing in a non-war context, once we've established that there are possible differences? So this seems to parallel the trolley problem to a certain extent. There are many other parallels, a topic also discussed here once many years ago, I think in one of the medical ethics society meetings. There has been major discussion to be had, which Moshe Feinstein was involved in one instance, of the separation of Siamese twins. Can you perform a surgery when you're going to save one of the twins, but the surgery will cause the death of the other twin? So is that something that is permissible to do? That has some parallel here also, as we'll see, but we're running out of time, so just to quickly explain how this seems to connect to what we've spoken about. So the Chazon Ish, in his Sefer on Sanhedrin, in Siman Chaf Hei, the Chazon Ish has a suggestion that he thinks this should be permissible, though he's not sure, but he thinks this should be permissible. Why? Because this action of diverting the missile, or perhaps also of diverting the train, that action is a Maisa Hatzalah. That is an act of salvation that you are performing. And the fact that it's also going to have a negative consequence is secondary. But it's not comparable to our typical Yehari Vayavar situations where you're going to shoot an innocent person, you're going to kill an innocent person. That's, for lack of a better term, a Maisa Achzarius. That's an act of cruelty, an act of aggression, perhaps would be a better translation in this context, an act of aggression against that individual. So that we're not going to allow. But in this case, your act is an act of Hatzalah. Your act is an act of salvation. And that's how we could look at it. Although he's not 100% sure. He's not sure how to conclude on that point. So it's interesting. Rav Asher Weiss, I've heard him verbally mention this Chazon Ish with great reverence, and note that this is a reflection of the fact that the Chazon Ish was on a level like a Rishon. I thought that type of thinking was very, very impressive. In his Sefer on Chumash, so he's a little more astonished by it. He says he's not sure where the Chazon Ish got this from, because he says on the surface one would think that you're not permitted to kill innocent people no matter what, that there is no license that we've seen so far. So I think based on what we've said so far, we can understand where the Chazon Ish is coming from. That when it comes to Ritzicha, so Ritzicha is an issue that has consequentialist aspects and has formalist aspects as well. So when we're dealing with just the consequentialist aspects, if we had license to just look at it through that lens, so then we could do the math and we could say that if many people are threatened and we could save them with sacrificing one non-threatened person, so then consequentially it makes sense. But we still have the formalist principle. The formalist principle is still there, and that stops us from making that decision. And by the way, the formalist principle, we didn't fully explore this, could be for reasons like we said before, just because we're not comfortable allowing individuals to decide when they're going to kill us and when they're not going to kill us. Or it could be more than that. It could be that when it comes to the Torah and the prohibition of Lo Sirtzach, it has to do with a reverence for life that has to be absolute, and therefore we can't take actions against life, against innocent life, even when it otherwise consequentially would make sense. But either way, it seems that Ritzicha has both a consequentialist aspect and a formalist aspect. So it seems what's driving the Chazon Ish here is the Chazon Ish is saying, in this case, perhaps you're addressing both. Because from the consequentialist perspective, it makes sense to divert this missile. And from the formalist perspective, it also perhaps is being addressed, because since your action shouldn't be viewed as an act of Ritzicha, but rather it should be viewed as an act of Hatzalah, an act of salvation, you're doing this to save the innocent lives, so therefore those two elements together, maybe that justifies such a path. Maybe that's what makes it okay, because we've addressed both components. So it's a very fascinating position of the Chazon Ish. There is a more recently released sefer called Uri V'Yishi, beautiful essays on Parshia, Sefer on Moadim. So in Sefer on Bereishis, he has an essay about this and talking about Parshas Vayishlach. And there he notes this position of the Chazon Ish as well, and he wonders, why is it that the Chazon Ish is unsure about it at the end? He says the Chazon Ish's conclusion, he's still not 100% sure that this is the path to take, so why is he not sure? So he goes on to explore this idea of a Maisa Hatzalah as opposed to a Maisa Achzarius. He says, how do we define when something is called an act of saving as opposed to an act of aggression? Because it seems somewhat subjective. It seems like you could just label it one way or the other in some of these situations. So he thinks the question is this action something which will directly harm someone else, or is the harm going to be as a result, but it's not something that is direct? So in a situation where somebody says, shoot an innocent person or I'll shoot you, so then you're directly acting aggressively against someone, so that is viewed as an action of aggression, even though the reason you're doing it is to save your life or someone else's life, your motive is still Hatzalah, but still that's viewed as an act of aggression. So when is it called a Maisa Hatzalah purely? So he thinks that maybe if it's a step removed, if your action is going to save someone, and as a separate consequence, someone else will get hurt, so then we could say that that is an act of saving someone. So Gramma is already a different level, so that's the question.
We like the Gramma.
So Gramma is a discussion of itself. But so presumably here, he's saying maybe the Chazon Ish is unsure about how to view the diverting of the missile onto somebody else. Is that considered to be something that is a step removed? You're just taking it away from hurting this larger group of people, and the fact that it's going to hurt someone else is less direct, or essentially it's happening at the same time, and really that is basically direct, and he thinks that's maybe his suffix. That's maybe why he's not sure how to classify it, but he thinks theoretically there is a logic to this, that that is something that could be the determinant here. Do we see it as an act of Hatzalah, or do we see it as an act of aggression, even though maybe motivated by Hatzalah? And that's a part of the discussion. Just to mention one or two other points, are just about out of time, which would be an act of aggression if we keep it going too long, but just to mention how you find this a little bit in some other sources. So as the review issue notes, there is a Chavis Yar that is quoted in the Pisrei Tshuva in Yerideya and Reish Nun Vav. It's coming in Hilchos Staka, that we know there is a whole discussion about when we redeem captives or not. And we know that we're a little bit wary sometimes of redeeming captives because of the impact it could have on everyone else. Maybe they'll take more captives and the like. So nonetheless, the Chavis Yar is quoted by the Pesachei Tshuva, and no one seems to disagree that if somebody is himself a captive and he wants to escape, and he knows that by escaping, everyone who's left behind is going to get treated worse, is going to pay the price for his escaping, he still thinks it's permissible for that person to escape. And there it seems to be that there's a combination of factors, that this person is pursuing an act of salvation for himself, so it's not an effort to try to hurt someone else as much as it is his saving himself, and the fact that it's done on his own behalf, in his own self-interest, which also makes it clearer what the motive is. So there he thought that that was essentially what was animating that thinking. And it's interesting just to note, and because we're running out of time, we'll probably have to close with this, and we'll just quickly review But there is a discussion of Pnei Yehoshua, which seems to be a forerunner of the Chazon Ish's possession, and many of the later Sfarim talk about this. If you know the history of the Pnei Yehoshua, I think I remember reading about this as a child, as an art scroll children's book about the biography of the Pnei Yehoshua, so you can read this in a simple version. Right, exactly, right. The Pnei Yehoshua, the reason he wrote his Sefer was because he was trapped in a very terrible fire. There was a horrific incident with a fire, and he was saved, and he had made a commitment that if he was saved from the fire, he made a promise to Kadosh Baruch Hu, if he was saved from the fire, he's going to write a Sefer going through Shas very carefully, trying to explain what the Rashi is saying, what the Tosfos is saying, etc. So afterwards, he wrote his Sefer to redeem the promise that he had made when he was saved from this fire. So in the introduction, he talks about the fire and how horrible it was, and he talked about how the people who came to try to save people from the fire, it was such a terrible situation that more people died as a result of what the rescue team was doing than would have died before that, than had died otherwise. The actions that were done to try to save people caused more people to die. So he writes in the context of discussing this that nonetheless he doesn't think that there's any guilt associated with the rescuers for bringing about this situation, because he writes kavanosum lahatzil, their intention was to try to help the situation, even though it resulted in unfortunately more people dying. Thinks that that still was a justified act, so therefore that's something to keep in mind. So it seems, again, this idea of action that is an action of Hatzalah, like the Chazon Ish spoke about, was here alluded to by the Pnei Yehoshua, and that seems to also be a part of this thinking. As the later Sfarim point out, it's not clear from what the Pnei Yehoshua describes, was it that the people who died were people who were not previously threatened? Were they the rescuers themselves? Were they other people who somehow became threatened because of the situation? Or are they people who died earlier because of what was happening, but they were already in a situation of danger? That's something that's not clear in what the Pnei Yehoshua describes, and that's also clearly a part of the issue. So a lot more to discuss, but not much more time. So let's just quickly review the highlights that we spoke about. So we spoke about the question of formalism and consequentialism, of different attitudes in terms of assessing moral issues, and how one of the primary examples is lying. Do you say lying is always wrong, or do you say it's okay when, or it's right, and you're talking about the consequence that will be beneficial? And that's something we see in this upcoming week's parsha, in Parshas Vayera, where we find one of the sources for the idea of mutter or mitzvah l'shanes b'fnei hashalom, and there's a big discussion in the later Sfarim. Do we say that it's not considered a moral problem at all in this case, or to say that it is a moral problem but it's outweighed by the issue of harmony, and how exactly you assess that has a number of ramifications. And we discuss the question of whether any of us, or the Torah, or us as individuals, do we have attitudes that are just across the board consequentialist or formalist, or do our attitudes shift depending on the nature of the issue? So it seems like it shifts, because when it comes to lying, presumably all of us would lie to save someone's life. That's a consequentialist approach. But when it comes to murder, we see that there seems to be a formalist approach. The Gemara says, Yihari v'yavar, we don't do it no matter what. And it's interesting to discuss that the Gemara explains this based on the principle of Maichazis. How do you assess that your blood is redder than someone else's blood? Which maybe is a consequentialist type of statement, saying that if you could do the math, you would do it, but we can't do the math, so we don't. Or maybe it's a formalist statement, maybe it's a way of saying that we simply can't go down that route. We're not able to make that assessment, and that's why we have formalist principles in the first place, because we don't trust individuals to make such a decision. It's going to have too negative an effect on society. And we noted that the Rambam Paskins like the view that you can't turn over one of your group to be killed, even if the whole group will be killed, unless that person is actually chamisa, against the other view in the Yerushalmi and Trumas, that you can hand over that one person, even if he's not chayv misa, which was the view Paskin like the Yad Rama and the Meiri and the Shulchan Aruch. So it seems to be that the Rambam is taking a very formalist approach here, that even if it seems to be clearly, consequentially indicated that you should do it, you still don't do it, because you don't hand over people to be killed or murder people at all. And the Chesed Mishnah notes that Maichaz is not really the only reason for this principle. It was a tradition the rabbis had, and this is one of the ways of expressing it. So then we considered the question of how all of this impacts wartime ethics, how we're allowed to be in a conflict with other nations and to kill people. It's a topic that comes out of Parshas Lech Lecha, that here Avram, when he turns down all the money that's being, all the material goods that's being offered to him, so he says he's not interested, but it seems like there were other considerations as well. And the Chavetz Chaim Soloveitchik discusses that he was concerned, was his war in this situation, was this simply an act of saving somebody from a rodef? That was one thing. Or was it actually a melchama, which has broader parameters, which would allow him to take these material goods, and also have allowed him to kill people who weren't actually threatening him? And Rashi, in the beginning of Perek Tezvav, Rashi says that indeed Avram was worried about that, that maybe he had a price to pay for having killed people in war, and that was the issue that he was trying to figure out. So we have this notion that there is a different metric when we're talking on a scale of Milchama. We have to figure out what the source that is. Rav Asher Weiss notes that it's something that emerges from Tanakh, and therefore that seems to be the basis. And we noted, as Rav Schechter explains in his Sefer, that it has to do with seeing the world through, seeing the conflict through a national lens rather than an individual lens. So as an individual, you can only direct your actions against the person who's actually threatening you, not anyone else who happens to be around. But when viewed as a national scale, that shifts things, and also could mean it could address territory as well. If a nation is coming to take over your territory and not attacking people, still that goes to the pikuach nefesh of the nation, and that might be relevant. And we spoke about the Mechas Chinuch's discussion of whether pikuach nefesh exists as a concept during Melchama, and we noted that it does exist, but just on a different scale, seen nationally rather than individually. And then we talked about how that still means, okay, mihochos rodeif, it means that you can take aggressive action, but it has to be focused, it has to not go beyond what's necessary. And then we talked about how the concept of din also theoretically would require one nation maybe even to take action against another nation that's violating the Noahide code. But there again, as we saw through the perspective of Aaron Soloveitchik, it's not an absolute, but it means that we should look at it through what's necessary in order to maintain order, no more and no less. That's a part of the discretion. Then we considered the trolley problem, which is also a part of the wartime issue. So what about causing the death of an unthreatened individual in order to save the lives of many more people who are threatened? And we discussed that the reason this is an issue is because we see murder through a formalist lens, because consequentially it seems like a straight decision, but since we look at things formalistically, so then we understand that we have to weigh this a little more carefully. And we saw the Chazon Ish thought that it's possible to say, in a similar situation of diverting a missile, that there, that's something that could be permitted because it's a maisa hatzala rather than a maisa achzarius, an aggressive action. And we noted that Rav Asher Weiss thought this was a very surprising position, where you see such a hetta for that. And we explained that we could understand it if we look at it through, if we look at murder through formalist and consequentialist lenses. And what the Chazon Ish is saying, in this case, both are addressed. It's both consequentially indicated and formalistically addressed, because this is not an action of Tzicha, it's an action of salvation, and that's why it should be permitted. And we noted that the Arivish, she asks, so if that's the case, so why is the Chazon Ish not sure about this? And he talked about how do you define what's an aggressive act and what's an act of salvation. Maybe it has to do with indirect and direct, and in this situation, maybe this is a little bit more direct. That's the suffix. And we just noted also the Chavis Yar, the Pesachei Tshuva says that you can, if you're a prisoner, you can run away, even though that's going to have a negative impact on the other prisoners, because that's an act of salvation for yourself. And how the Pnei Yeshua discusses the fire that he was caught in and how people died in the fire as a result of the rescue efforts, but that was presumably not guilt-inducing because they did this in order to save lives, and this is a forerunner of the Chazon Ish's position. And all of this is relevant to trying to assess what exactly is the moral and halachic approach within all of these contexts. There's much more to say about this, but we're way out of time, so we will stop there. Again, end with apology again. Sorry for going over time, and I wish you all a wonderful day.